You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1 FM and freakradio.org. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. You can hear this show every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are commercial-free, collectively run, and have been operating without a license from the U.S. government since 1995. My very special guest on the telephone this evening is Michael Parenti. And he is an author, an activist, and according to him, a recovering academic. And he has written quite a few books about politics and is considered a political analyst. He has written Democracy for the Few, which is in its eighth printing. And his most recent book from City Lights is Contrary Notions, and that was published in 2007. And Michael Parenti will be here in Santa Cruz on Wednesday, February 4th at 7 o'clock at Loudon Nelson Community Center. This will be a benefit event for this radio station, Free Radio Santa Cruz, and I'm grateful that he is willing to do that for us and give us that support. And the talk that evening is titled War on Prosperity. Again, Michael Parenti will be here in Santa Cruz Wednesday, February 4th, and it'll be a talk, and the event is $10. Tickets are available at Capitola Book Cafe, and there'll be a fundraising dinner happening before that at the Malabar Cafe. And Michael Parenti, I want to welcome you to Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Thank you, John.
And thank you so much for agreeing to do this benefit for us. We all are very appreciative of that, and we're looking forward to having you in Santa Cruz again. Thank you, Michael.
Okay, my pleasure.
And I have read Contrary Notions, and I enjoyed it very much. It covers a lot of territory and reminded me of a lot of the work that you've done over the years, writing about politics in the United States, writing about media, writing about technology and corporate capitalism. And I wonder if you might start by talking about the independent press. And this radio station, as you know, is unlicensed. And there's a section of your book, Contrary Notions, where you're talking about news media, and you write that the airwaves are the property of the people of the United States. And you also write that there is no free and independent press in the United States. I wonder if you'd elaborate a little on the ownership of airwaves and how that doesn't always happen.
The press is not free or independent because the ownership pattern is highly concentrated, and only those with enormous amounts of capital can own the major networks. So the the mainstream media are not close to corporate America or friendly or biased toward corporate America. They are an integral part of corporate America. Each of the networks is owned by the giant private corporations. At the boards of all the networks, the boards of directors in all the networks, are people who are drawn from major corporations. The major advertisers, about half of all the ads you see on TV are car ads. They're the auto industry and the pharmaceutical industry and the all sorts of other household industries, cosmetic industries, and the like are all part of corporate America. Now, these people do not put out money for nothing, and they are known to cut off sponsorship of programs, not because their product has been insulted. Occasionally, that might be the case. But more often, it's because they feel the program that they're sponsoring is one that is taking too liberal a drift. And so they exercise a control. These advertisers do. And besides the advertisers, they're the owners. News Corporation is owned by Rupert Murdoch, which has Fox News and Fox Sports and Fox this and all that. That particular network is an unabashed propaganda instrument for the most reactionary component of the Republican Party. People like Hannity and O'Reilly and the like. And Karl Rove has a place, has a home on Fox News now that he left the White House. So where's your liberal press? Why do they talk about the liberal press? Because the press does, or the media at times do, report on events outside. And events in the real world are very radical, you see. Reality is radical. So if they start to reflect things from reality, this is when the right-wingers get very annoyed. Let me give you an example. When the more centrist, conservative, but not reactionary media reports and shows pictures of coffins of Americans who were killed in Iraq, that is news. That's reality. That's not something we left-wing ideologues cooked up and made up and argued and fantasized about. That's reality. American soldiers are getting killed in Iraq. But for somebody like Fox News, that's a perfect example of the leftist bias media, that by showing those coffins, they talk down the war and make the war unpopular among the American public, and they make they try to be making George Bush look bad. So they see the reporting of reality by publicizing news about growing unemployment. They see that as you making trying to paint the worst picture. You're a propagandist when you report things about reality that they don't like. You're grinding an axe, they say. So this is how they can again and again push and keep pushing the mainstream media toward the right and keep them defensive and the like, while at the same time continually calling it the liberal media, or as that reactionary Rudy Giuliani called it, the leftist media. That's what he called it, the leftist media at the Republican National Convention. What leftist commentators are there in the major media? Where are the leftists? There's one little sliver on Friday evening, which is a very poor TV evening, actually. Or let's say not the best TV evening, where Bill Moyers is on, and he does some things that are marginally critical and editorializing. But that's about it, you know. One or two people like that. But most of them are straining constantly toward dressing up their right, showing that they are nonpartisan and all that. All the liberals are constantly worrying about being and looking too liberal, and they're constantly shifting and shuffling over and kissing up to the right. They're never happier than when they're apologizing to the right, or they're never happier than when they can point out and say, well, we don't really disagree on that. We agree with you. Oh, yeah, we agree that. Yeah. So it's a pathetic kind of loaded, one-sided media that is loaded to the right while still convincing millions of people that it's a left-wing media. And the fact that they can convince so many millions of people that it's a liberal media is testimony to their right-wing propaganda efficacy.
Tell me, Michael, you have in your book, Contrary Notions, there's a section where you're talking about ecology, and it's titled Why the Corporate Rich Oppose Environmentalism. And you write that capitalism undermines ecology, and ecology is subversive of capitalism. I wonder if you could explain more about what you mean by that. And also, connected to that, I think, the next section in the book is what is to be done about our situation in the United States. And you list quite a few specific possibilities: mass transit development, tax the super rich, put a cap on campaign spending, release political prisoners, provide health care, quite a few things like that. Tell me, so you're more about your analysis of how capitalism undermines ecology, and then the possibilities of socialism in the United States.
The essence of capitalism is to treat the natural environment as a disposable product of infinite quantity. There's no thought that we may be running out of these resources. You just plunder the resources and take them and pursue them for profit. Take oil. Oil is a fossil fuel which is causing global warming and now putting the entire planet at risk. Well, what does the capitalist do? When this global warming begins to actually melt down the Arctic, what do the capitalists do? Do they say, oh my gosh, the product that we have manufactured and marketed at such profit for ourselves, that product is destroying the planet? No, they don't say that. What they say is the Arctic is opening up. There are other oil reserves. We can now get at them because the permafrost is melting and because the North Pole, the ice caps are melting, and now we can get at, in other words, get at more oil for more fossil fuel to perpetrate more global warming. So right there, you see, there's no concern about the survivability of the planet, the survivability of that kind of energy system, the sustainability of such an energy system. All the concern is, how do we make more money? How do we exploit and take whatever is available? Are you still there, John?
Yes.
Yeah. Whatever is available of the Earth's resources. We have a right to whatever's left of the Earth's resources, to exploit them and use them any way we want, as we choose, and limitlessly. We have a right to treat these resources as limitlessly, when in fact, treat them as limitless, when in fact they are limited. We have a right to consider our only immediate gains and profits rather than long range, or really not long range. I'm so sick of our side of people talking about how this is going to jeopardize our children's lives and our grandchildren's lives. And this is supposed to tug at our heartstrings. For gosh sakes, it's jeopardizing our lives right now. It's poisoning people right now with this lack of, with what it's doing to the air and the water and the food. So capitalism is just not geared. It's not made to it's not made to consider ecology at all. I'm gonna switch phones for a second here. Just
okay.
Hang on.
Okay. I'm speaking with Michael Parenti, author
Hello.
Of Contrary Notions, and he will be in Santa Cruz on Wednesday, February 4th, for a fundraising benefit event for Free Radio Santa Cruz. And Michael, there you are.
Yes, and we'll have copies of Contrary Notions available, I think, right?
Of course we'll have copies of your latest book and whatever else you want to bring and have
okay.
available, books, you know, and tapes and so on. You, at the beginning of Contrary Notions, you open the book talking about just how hard it is for people to look at things from a different angle than they have been used to looking at it, politically or socially. You write that how seldom we bother to explore in some critical fashion the fundamental preconceptions that shape our understanding of social and political life. And then at the very end of the book, there's a section called My Strange Values. And you're talking about yourself with some sense of humor. And you write that since rather early in life, I've been at odds with conventional values of this society. And you talk about cars and desire for money and desire for authority over people and not being enticed by those things and not being dedicated to your own self-advantage. So I'm wondering, what can you say led to your abilities, even early in life, to be able to see things from a different point of view and maybe get outside of preconceptions that are dominant around you?
First of all, I should qualify that and point out that there were many conventional values that I ascribed to, of course. I mean, I was raised as a Catholic boy, and I was raised in a Italian-American working-class family and neighborhood. So I was not really at the cutting edge of, you know, new views or such, but the ones you mentioned are true. I was never interested in money and cars and things of that sort. There are two kinds of people. There are people who have things and want to have things and dream of having things and dedicate much of their energy to having things. And then there are people who do things, and I preferred to be one of the people who did things, although I didn't really do very much. What I really wanted to do was, maybe there's a third category, people who seek things or think about things and try to understand knowledge or society or history or what's happening and what's the truth and what isn't the truth. So I did have that inclination. I don't know where it came from. Of course, my folks were not, you know, they were not educated and did not in any way foster such thoughts. And in fact, they kind of puzzled and sometimes marveled, sometimes shook their heads over it when I did surface with this or that thought. But I had plenty of ordinary convention. You know, I was a New York Yankee fan and so forth and so on. I was in a gang on the streets in East Harlem. I mean, it was, the gangs in those days were just clustered. We didn't carry guns or switchblades or anything. So it's really hard to say where you get your ideas from or whatever. I think I get a lot of them from inside my own head. People always say, who's influenced you? What writers influence? I think I've been heavily, heavily influenced by Michael Parenti. You know, I just can't escape that guy.
He always seems to be right there.
Oh yeah, what a pain, man, to be him 24 hours a day. It's not that easy, you know.
You know, what's really wonderful about Contrary Notions, there's a lot of your ideas laid out very clearly. And then the last section is really nice because it is personal, and there are some stories about you and your family and growing up.
The last section is in the middle. I put stuck that in the middle of the book.
Maybe it is the middle.
Yeah.
Around page 239, there's a story about you getting your PhD, and you tell your father, you know, I'm about to get my PhD, and he was delivering bread, this Italian bread in New York, and
wonderful bread, yeah, delicious.
And he said to you, "Okay, now that your education's out of the way, are you ready to do some real work?" And you write that you almost said yes to him.
Yeah, you know, he never really said, "Well, now your education's out of the way," but that was it, because he then just said, "You want to come into business with me now? Are you free to do that?" And I was kind of touched by that, but I had other ambitions at that point.
There's a little bit in the book about difficulties that teachers and professors have had if they have a radical or outside of the mainstream point of view, teachers being fired or not hired. And you, I wasn't sure exactly your experiences with that. You mentioned one experience at Cornell where students called you biased because of what you were teaching. Did you have any experiences where you were actually not hired or fired because of your point of view?
Well, the Cornell thing was they said, we're getting only one point of view here. And I said, well, we do have other readings and other points of view. I said, but generally you're right. But I said, and how many of you have taken other social science courses? And this was a senior class, senior and junior class, upper class. And they had all taken many social science and communication and all that. And I said, and how many of you got this point of view in those other classes? And not a single hand went up. And that shows you the ideological diversity of Cornell University. And then I said, and how many of you complained that you were getting only one point of view? And, of course, not a hand went up. So I said, so you're not complaining that you're getting only one point of view, but that for the first time you're getting a second, an alternative point of view, and you can't tolerate it. And that's really reflects the homogeneity of Cornell and all most of these other schools that many of the teachers, and again, it's a very strange case, very much like the media. Academia is called by the right wing, is constantly complained that it's a nest of left wingers and such. And here and there, you do find some radicals in teaching positions. But by left wingers, they mean that the great majority of academics are probably liberals. But every school has conservative academics. Almost every department has some conservatives. The administrations of academics, the boards of directors, again, are from corporate America, and they have the final say on who's hired, who's fired, salaries, formation of departments, and the like. They're all right-wingers. So to really call academia left-wing bias, yeah, people with a maybe liberal or critical perspective are more inclined to go into academia than become police or military officers. They don't, you see, now, the conservatives, when you say to them, what about all those conservatives, you know, who are judges and cops and and military officers and such, they say, well, that's self-selecting, you know, those are the people who go in. And pick that. They don't consider that it's self-selecting for academia, but that's what it is, that the conservatives are busy, want to make money, and they don't go into academia because they don't want to work for that kind of salary. Generally, usually, they're off in the business world. Most of your business managers are conservative. Is that because of a bias in hiring? Well, in some cases, it is. They wouldn't hire anybody who says, let's take a good chunk of our budget and give it to radical causes or something. He wouldn't last a day. But for the most part, that's self-selecting. Yet they carry on this crusade to keep academia in a defensive position and, you know, shuffling over toward the center and to the right and the like. And there's a lot of repression. I gave a lot of examples, including several from my own career in that chapter, and numerous other people who were all very capable scholars who were productive, who had written interesting things, who taught interesting and challenging courses, and yet they were let go. And they were let go for those very reasons, because they were so inclined to be so biased.
You have chosen as the title for your talk here in Santa Cruz on February 4th, The War on Prosperity. And I wonder if you would say a few words about that.
I don't want to steal my own thunder, of course, John, we want it to be a surprise, right? We want people to come. But I'll just give you a hint. The hint is, actually, it's a key point. key point is that capitalism always claims that it is the generator of prosperity. And I argue that, in fact, one of the goals of capitalism is to hold back prosperity and to discourage it. That prosperity becomes a challenge and a threat to the corporate profit system. And I'd be able to flesh that out. And also, prosperity is not the regular product of capitalism. Most of the world is capitalist, and most of the world is poor and getting poorer. So that's all I'll tell you right now. And if you want to hear any more of those intriguing ideas, they got to come on February, right?
Yeah, February 4th at Loudoun Nelson Community Center, and it's a Wednesday night, and the event is $10. Michael Parenti will be talking.
Where will this be, in Santa Cruz?
Yes.
Right, Santa Cruz, yeah.
Santa Cruz, and February 4th, 2009, and it's called War on Prosperity, and that's a good little taste, and I'm glad you don't want to give away too much. People can come and hear a whole lecture about that.
And related subjects that will be in the lecture.
Great. A lot of people in the so-called left have been pretty excited about Barack Obama and his campaign and then winning the election. He's made appointments now. And I'm wondering what your take is, what you are thinking is going to happen with Obama regarding the current U.S. wars, military funding, and the economic difficulties, and you know what your analysis is of this new president.
I felt no excitement by his election. I didn't feel any thrill of any kind. I was glad that he beat the horrible John McCain, who was just a slime bag, lying hitman, maligning person, and dangerous, and that running mate of his from Alaska, the two of them. I mean, out. So I was glad he beat them, but I didn't feel any big excitement. I didn't feel for those people, black and white, who see his victory, you know, African American in the White House. My gosh, yeah, that is in a way kind of amazing, and yet it's not that important in terms of what the real crises and needs of the African American community is. So it was never about race for most of the people who voted for Obama, tell you the truth. Maybe for a lot of the people who voted against him, it was about race. So it was really nice to slap down the racists and just give them the defeat, shove this defeat down their throats, which they deserve so thoroughly. But it's no big deal. When the crises and the injustices and the terrible deprivations that are being faced by the working class African American community in this country, when those are really engaged and confronted and rolled back and improved upon and challenged, then I'll go dance in the streets. But until then, I don't see it as, you know, it's a barometer that at least there's some opinion is changing. You can have a black person, but what's the political payoff? That's you know, when India selected Indira Gandhi, a woman, to be Prime Minister of India. So, you know, that's fine. Could you then turn around and say, oh, the women of India now have achieved equality? The hell they have. I mean, they're still getting mistreated and raped and whatever else, and they're still having a tough time with the legal system, with the abuses by men and such, terrible struggles. So and so it is. I mean, the victory for Obama means maybe we've moved past. I mean, certainly the generations of struggle against racism and for civil rights is not something I want to brush aside and say, oh, it's all just futile and a hoax, and people are just as racist today as they were during slavery, or just as bad. That's absurd. No, there have been important gains, and it's a very good barometer that you can actually say, you know, that a black man is now. I mean, and to see African American woman like Michelle Obama, she's the first lady. Well, that's I get a bigger kick out of that, I think, and the lovely kids and all. But I have no hope. I have no great expectations. He's already picked people who, some of whom are disappointing, and you're not going to expect too much. And then a few who are outrageously bad. I mean, Admiral Blair to be National Director of Intelligence, that guy should be tried as a war criminal for what he did with the Indonesian army against the Timorese, even against orders from Washington. I mean, he has blood on his hands, and you pick him to be your National Director of Intelligence, you know? And who else? Well, Petraeus or Gates, Robert Gates to go in there as Secretary of Defense. That's awful, really. I mean, this guy is ready to jump into the Afghanistan quagmire. And so I'm not particularly excited. Manuel is another one, you know. These are not people. He's got retreads, not just from the Clinton administration, but from the Bush administration, the two I just mentioned. Yeah,
this is all surprising to me too, because a lot of people in the left were very excited, and he is bringing along with him people that, like you say, have been involved in a lot of military actions. And
right, and he's praised for being not being ideological but being pragmatic. You see, whenever you pick these conservatives and these operators, who are all, they all have their ideologies. They all have ideologies about wealth, about corporate America, about making investments safe, about extending U.S. power, about opposing any movement or leader or nation that tries to use its land, labor, and resources in a different way outside of the global free trade corporate system. They're all wedded to that and committed to that. That's their ideology. But that's all seen as pragmatic, as you know, because it's the dominant way. You're not trying to stand up against it. Whereas somebody like you or me or people who work at your station, we stand up against it, and we're immediately labeled ideological. And they're just being realistic and pragmatic. So he's being praised. They're heaping praise on him for this right of center team that he's putting together. You know, and this is the change he kept talking about. We got to have the courage. Yes, we can. Yes, we can. We're going to change. Now he's another Bill Clinton, I think, about as bad as that. I think politically more literate than Clinton. Maybe a little less self-indulgent, but other than that, I have no big excitement about it. It's up to us to keep struggling and pushing in a progressive direction. And he's coming in facing colossal problems. And he talks about having to spend trillions and trillions of dollars. While only a handful of billions are going to go for new jobs and such, where's all that money going to go? It's scary almost, some of it. And on that happy note, I think it's a wrap. What do you say?
That sounds fine.
Okay.
I deeply appreciate having the opportunity to speak with you, Michael Parenti. And Michael's latest book is Contrary Notions from City Lights Books. And I enjoyed very much reading through the book and reading through your ideas from over the years. And Michael will be here in Santa Cruz on February 4th, Wednesday night. It's a 7 o'clock event at Loudon Nelson Community Center. And the talk will be on the War on Prosperity. Tickets are available at the Capitola Book Cafe, and there will be a dinner beforehand. Also, this is a benefit for Free Radio Santa Cruz. And I wonder, Michael, if you would be willing...
Is the public invited to the dinner? I don't get it.
Yes. It's but there's only room for maybe 20 or 30 people, so it's kind of first...
Tell them where the dinner is or the details of it? I don't know.
Yeah, it's at the Malabar Cafe, downtown Santa Cruz, and that, I believe, is at 5:30 p.m., and we'll be...
We'll talk and, for food, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and it's actually, we're giving a deal. The dinner is $80, and that includes the meal, and Michael will be there at the dinner, and then that includes reserved seating at the event, and also a copy of Contrary Notions. And it's $140 for two people, for a couple, to come to that fundraising dinner at the Malabar Cafe on February 4th.
Well, this is Michael Parenti, and we're listening to Free Radio in Santa Cruz, which we should listen to at every opportunity we can get.
Michael, thank you so much for speaking with me this evening, and I look forward to seeing you on February 4th here in Santa Cruz. Thank you.
Right. Bye-bye.
Good night. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM, and we broadcast also on the internet at freakradio.org. My name is John Malkin, and this program is The Great Leap Forward.